and then we'll look at it. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who was born king of the Jews? For we saw his star, we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod and the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for it is so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring him me word that I too may come and worship him." After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our Lord will stand forever. We're going to look at this passage within three headings. We're going to look at the kings of worship. It's really a scene of worship. The battle in worship, both in the text and then in our lives as well. And then the wonder of worship. So first, the kings of worship. I want you to note there's two kings in this passage here this morning. Two who demand worship, but in very different ways. Right? First one, verse 2. Where is he who was born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him. This is the magi, right? They're the wise men, they're coming. The word there in the Greek is means to prostrate, to fall before, fall on their faces, right? That's what the word literally means, and they come to desire to do that. And then we read that word again in verse 8. Herod sort of fakes it. He says, "I want to do the same thing. Go find them, and then give me word, and then I'll come and worship and fall down before this child." And then verse 11, that is the actual reaction of the three when they actually come into the presence of this king, this baby king Jesus. They fall down when they get close to the baby and worship him. It's interesting to think about even who these guys are, these three wise men, right? They're foreigners. They're not from Israel, so that's a perplexing thing for a Jew, because the Jews didn't always get along with their neighbors. They had battles with them, so they're outsiders to the story of the Old Testament leading up to this time. These guys are essentially ancient Near East astrologers. That's really kind of what they are. And apologies to those who read the horoscopes, but astrologers, these are astrologers. This is who God has revealed to, is astrologers in their day. They're sort of a pay grade ahead of the shepherds, right? If you read Luke's gospel account, shepherds sort of one of the lowest rung, and that's how Luke, those are the people who Luke has as celebrating the baby's birth. And astrologers were not that highly regarded, particularly if you were a Jew, particularly Matthew, who's writing this. They're highly suspect in the rest of the Bible. They're usually against Yahweh, against Israel, right? And then here, what do we see as they come into this king? They're actually the first ones to whom to bow down to this new king, right? I don't know what Matt preached on, but it was already scandalous. I'm sure he made known in chapter 1, the scandalous women of Jesus' genealogy. So already Matthew starts his gospel. He has scandalous women, and now he has astrologers, pay grade ahead, the shepherds. You kind of just wonder, what is going on? Like, who is this king? And it shows us God's grace to the outsider, that he comes not just for the rich and powerful. In fact, he doesn't come first for the rich and powerful. He doesn't even come for those. He comes for those even outside of Israel, right? Foreign astrologers are the first subjects of this king. And ironically and sort of innocently, they go to Herod. They don't know the landscape as well. They're from another country. They go to Herod and ask, "Where is this king?" Maybe they presume that maybe it's the son the son of Herod. They don't know. They go there, and we know sort of know the backdrop of the story, going, this isn't going to go well, right? They're going and letting know about this other king. Herod's the second king who demands worship, right? This shows you how confusing times were back then. He was a non-Jew over the Jews. He was recognized as a true king by Rome, put there to rule over the Jewish people. He had a supposed conversion to Judaism that was supposed to make things go smoothly as he reigned as king, but he was a vicious king. You'll see that in a couple weeks to come. He was not a great ruler, and he's near the end of his life, and sometimes people get worried about their posterity at the end of their life, and he's sort of anxious about that. He's protective of his reign. And so there's these two kings that Matthew puts before to us this morning or this afternoon. Those are the kings of worship. The second is the battle in worship, right? Why is Herod troubled? Verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. The word there is a pretty intense word in the Greek. It means to be terrified, because he knows he doesn't reign legitimately. So he has this sense of, is there some other legitimate heir to the throne? I'm not the legitimate heir to the throne. I shouldn't be ruling over these people. He knows that. You know when things are right, wrong in your life, that you just never are quite settled about them. He's not settled about his reign, and so he's terrified. I mean, all Jerusalem is terrified with him. Either that means everyone was terrified, or that an enraged Herod was a concern for everyone in Jerusalem, right? If he's upset, Jerusalem's going to be upset. And he goes to great lengths to protect his power. He inquired of them as to where the Christ was to be born. He doesn't have the same reason, the same investigation that the Magi had. There's a sense of desperation. I got to know, where is he? When you find this king, this child, come and tell me, and I might come and worship him too. Of course, he wants to share no power, because he alone wants to be worshipped. That's the battle in worship. John Calvin, a great thinker in days past, speaking about Herod and maybe of us as well, says this. He says, "So long as wicked men think that it is taking nothing from themselves, they will yield to God and to Scripture some degree of reverence. But when Christ comes into close conflict with ambition, covetousness, pride, misplaced confidence, hypocrisy, deceit, they immediately forget all modesty and break into rage. Herod does not therefore attack men, but furiously dares to fight with God." Right? If it's, you know, it's just part of the job being king, he'll give a little bit of deference to Yahweh. But now all of a sudden it's cutting at the very heart of who he is and the very heart of his power, and he will have none of it. Right? Why this reaction? Because Herod knows that what we need to know in the battle and worship. Listen up. There can only be one king, right? There can only be one who is worshipped. The battle for worship is fought in the hearts of human beings. And as you guys go through the Gospel of Matthew, I encourage you to sort of put yourself in the place of some of these characters, right? Maybe you put yourself in place of the women in the genealogy and felt yourself as an outsider, as the Magi, right? And maybe that's easier to do. But how about Herod, right? How are you like Herod this afternoon? Clenching your fist, defending your territory, feigning worship even now. Who do you want to worship this evening? Now, we gathered here, it's a worship service, so hopefully you want to worship Jesus, right? But let me define worship as not just this service, but as what we do on Sunday afternoons or Sunday mornings, but just being what we do all the time, right? We're worshipers 24 hours a day. In the Brothers Karamazov, one of the lines is this: as long as man remains free, he strives for nothing so incessantly and so painfully as to find someone, or I'll add, something, to worship, right? So we're always worshiping. That's the battle in worship, is who are you worshiping? What are you worshiping? What is the thing that's set apart in your hearts? What's most valuable to you? What are you consumed with that where you derive your deep meaning and satisfaction? What do you give your best thoughts to? What do you give your best waking hours to in life? Those are the things, that is the thing that you worship. And at least, if you're honest, there's competition when it comes to Jesus for what you're worshiping, right? What competes for your heart? Do you really want Christ to rule? Just like Herod. Herod knows he doesn't want Christ to rule. Do you really want Christ to rule as king in your life? What are some other things that might compete with that? I'm of an age, you guys are younger, at least most of you are younger, where I have IRAs and sort of I'm saving money in them and I check them out. I try to keep myself at a point to not check too much, right? Particularly because they've gone down, they've gone up, they've gone down, they've gone up, they've gone down, they've gone down, they've gone down, they've gone down. Someone who has some IRAs is shaking in your head, right? It's natural to do that and sort of, you know, when I get my monthly report, I'm like, oh yeah, great. And the next month, oh man, that wasn't a good month. And a family member invests my money, so I sometimes think of that person positively or negatively, depending how the market is doing, right? But it's natural to have that feeling of being affected by those things, right? Those are, you know, because you think this is how I'll be able to retire someday. But if I'm undone by that, right, if I can't move on from that, then I have found the one to whom I'm falling down to, right, at least to some degree. Or maybe that's not a thing for you. Some of you are really young and you really don't even think about that at all. Maybe think about your reputation, right? Your prestige, what people think of you, whether at your job or at school or at home or in this church or in the larger community. And you think of people whether, you know, if you're unduly sort of buoyed up by what people think or unduly crushed by what people think, then you have found your king, right? You have found the one to whom you competes with Jesus for your worship, right? Some of us, it's quieter now here with less kids in here. We have a lot of kids at Grace, and they don't all leave anymore, so that's always a little bit more noise than this. Kids are great. I got three of them. One of them left to help with children's worship. I think parenting is sort of an 18-year or more experiment in thinking less of yourself, right? It's just sort of God's good way to think less of yourself. But in our culture, this is not the culture of the Bible, but our culture, kids are very central. In fact, sometimes too central. They can almost be worshipped, right? I don't know if you have that. If you have children, if you have that tendency, maybe at times I have become obsessed with sometimes with my kids' basketball leagues that I coach, or obsessed with my daughter getting into this very prestigious service thing in Hanover County that I realized that. That's what I start bowing down to, right? That's what I start paying attention. That starts where it's competing for allegiance to Jesus. And you think, you know, family, that can't be a bad thing, but it can be a bad thing when it becomes who you're worshiping and what you're all about, right? And Jesus has several hard things to say about that. If you doubt me, you can take it up with Jesus. I could go on continually, right, with things, different things that battle for us when worship. But the question is this: are you comfortable with God being an accessory or the centrality of your life? Herod is fine with God being an accessory of his life. But he is at least honest. He gets what's at stake when he hears this, right? He sees the implications for his world, what's most important to him, the real threat, and it rages. And he says, no, I will be worshipped. I will be central. Does Herod deserve to be there? No, right? We know that. I mean, he wasn't even a good ruler. Like, it's one thing if he was a good ruler to maybe accept some worship, but he wasn't even good. So we know that. That's easy. But does your functional God deserve to be there, right? No. He, she, it, whatever it is, does not. Put that God to the test the same way. Does it deserve your best thoughts, your best hours? Have the courage to reflect in your life what competes with your worship. What's the battling for your worship this afternoon in your heart? Lastly, the wonder of worship. The wonder of worship. And we see it here at the end of our text, verses 11 and 10 and 11. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. That means they were blown away by what they saw. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. They fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. It fills them with wonder what they come upon, what they had journeyed to see back then on that day. And it causes them to just be filled with awe and wonder. And wonder is something that as you get older can sort of, you can lose the ability for wonder, right? We could bring the kids back in here because kids have that sense of wonder. They get wonder, and it's not just sort of doesn't mean just sort of being innocent. It means being willing to trust, being willing to believe, being willing to see how God is at work. My wife and I and our family actually are involved with a ministry called Young Life Capernaum It's if you know Young Life, it's Young Life's ministry to kids and young adults with special needs. And we've been doing it for the last 4 or 5 years in Hanover County. And we partner with a bunch of other churches that do it. And I heard this story. I thought, that's wonder. There's this 12-year-old boy that's connected to Capernaum a little bit, but he also goes to this other church. And his caretaker during the service or during the Sunday school lost track of him, which with this child is a problem because he could go anywhere. And it's a very large church with lots of places to go. But she heard him. It's Christmas time, and she heard him last week yelling up and down the halls, "It's Christmas! It's Christmas! It's Christmas!" And he was just running throughout the whole building yelling, "It's Christmas," because he loves Christmas. The wonder of Christmas really captures this young 12-year-old boy, and he like literally knocked over an old woman, so it became a problem, and he's running as fast as he can, and this woman, she's a little bit older, she can't catch up to him, and she sees there's ushers because he's running towards the service while the service is going on. And these two ushers at the last minute while he's like, "It's Christmas, it's Christmas, it's Christmas." They catch him before he runs into the auditorium, which I thought would have been an awesome thing, wouldn't it, for the service to have this young man run in going, "It's Christmas, it's Christmas." But they caught him and nabbed him. Big ushers, that's their job, I guess. But they ruined the wonder of Christmas. But he gets the wonder of Christmas, right? As we grow up, we become inoculated to wonder. Perhaps the greatest threat to our worship is not money and its allure. It's not reputation. It's not family. Perhaps it's just boredom with Jesus. Right? I've heard this before. "We three kings of Orient are." I've sung that before. Right? When is the last time the gospel took your breath away? For me, it was this morning because I didn't preach at Grace this morning. Someone else came and preached, and so I actually was sitting where you're sitting, and I'm usually not. I'm usually where I am right now. And so I got to hear and listen in a different way. It was a different morning for me. And so I kind of heard the gospel clearly through the guy who was preaching for us, and it blew me away, right? I can't force you to appreciate this baby that these men come upon. I wish I could force you to appreciate the wide grace of God that comes to these astrologers, to these shepherds, to all kinds of surprising people. I can't compel you to see in that child a savior. I can't always do that for myself, right? But I can invite you into this humble house to look at this little king who seems helpless, but we know, right, changes the course of human history more than any other king in history. Anne Weems, a poet, says it this way. She says, "Only God could send a little baby king, and we are on our knees." Right? They had an epiphany when they saw Jesus. Have you? When this wonder takes hold of your life, not just one-time event, but throughout your life, it does a few things, and we see it do a few things to these very these magi. It frees you, right? It frees you to give. They come bearing gifts, honoring this king. Hunter talked about, you know, if you can give as a part of worship, then give, right? And when you have the wonder of seeing who Jesus is, then giving your time and giving your talents and giving your resources are very easy to do. It frees you to give. It also frees you to live, right? Kind of wonder what else happened to these guys. We don't know much else that happened in their life after they came upon. But you can imagine that they lived differently in their life because they came upon Jesus. T.S. Eliot actually writes a poem. I'm going to try to read this in my best poetry voice. No, I don't really have a good poetry voice. I'm just going to read it. But he kind of talks about their thinking. They're kind of leaving that this episode, this encountering this king, and then their words about it. "All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down, this, were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation. With an alien people clutching their gods, I should be glad of another death." No longer at ease. Right? no longer at ease when they come upon this king, no longer at ease just to run after money and possessions and these other gods, no longer at ease to really care about reputation and prestige because their identity had been shaped by this king. No longer at ease to place family or another person at the center of your life because they had placed the king at the center of their life. They were free to live, right? To let go of the gods they clutched in their lives, and that's true for us as well. And then lastly, coming upon the wonder of Christmas, the wonder of this king, it frees you to risk, right? It frees you to risk. Look at verse 12. They didn't listen to Herod. They got a vision and a dream, but it still was pretty risky when the king of the land tells you, come back to me, to sort of not come back to him. They risked because after listening to the king, after seeing this new king, their allegiance was switched, right? And they risked, they dared to disobey Herod. They go another way. They risk because of this king. How are you called to risk in your life because of this king? Two kings, right? It's easy to see that Herod's demanding worship, but Jesus comes humbly, but he also comes regally, right? He demands worship as well, and the more impressive, he's more impressive the longer you look at him. His presence looms larger until finally his birth and his life and his death and his resurrection produce wonder and produce real life. Let us pray.